right. I'd like to call the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee to order. Representative, please note Representative Cassell is excused, and will Administrative Assistant Douglas, our new Administrative Assistant, Kiva, got a promotion, kind of. I mean, she's leaving this committee. It's not a promotion, but she does have a great opportunity. Welcome, Douglas, to the committee. We're going to miss Kiva, but Douglas, it's great to have you.
Thank you, Chair. All right, for role, Chair Altman.
Here.
Vice Chair Bell.
Here.
Ranking Member Chambliss.
Here.
Representatives Abbott.
Here.
Black.
Here.
Botana.
Here.
Buchanan.
Here.
Cassell is excused. Cross.
Here.
Gossett-Sieben.
Here.
Hart.
Here.
Kilbrew. Lopez.
Here.
Overdorf.
Yes, sir.
Trunell.
Trunell's here. I saw him.
Here. Right. We just can't hear him.
Okay.
All right. Chair, quorum is present.
Thank you, Douglas. With quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee meeting. Please make sure that your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. If there's any members of the public wishing to address the subcommittee, please fill out the appropriate appearance form and give it to the committee administrative assistant. And then we'll know that you have an interest in addressing the committee. Members, today we will hear two presentations. The first presentation will be an update from the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission on invasive plant management. The second presentation will be an update from the St. John's River Water Management District on Lake Apopka. Unless there's any other questions from the committee, we'll move forward on both of those. First up is Melissa Tucker, Director of Habitat, Species, and Conservation from FWCC. Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives. As you said, I'm Melissa Tucker. I'm the director of Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's Division of Habitat and Species Conservation. Today, I'm going to be presenting to you on FWC's plant management program, which is the largest plant management program in the country that covers both aquatic and upland invasive plants. Invasive plants have been an issue of concern for Florida for almost 150 years, with the introduction of water hyacinth in the 1880s, hydrilla in the 1950s, melaleuca and Brazilian pepper in the 1960s. In 1970, the state did pass two statutes that address the control and regulation of aquatic plants. Those statutes also direct research on methods of control and allowed for issuance of permits for the control of invasive plants. In 1993, the legislature added uplands on public conservation lands to the invasive plant program. Control of invasive plants was originally housed in the Department of Natural Resources, then the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, and in 2008, both programs moved to FWC along with the rules that govern their implementation. We do work closely with the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, which maintains the Florida Noxious Weed List and the Florida Prohibited Aquatic Plants List. FDACS also oversees the registration of herbicides that are used in the state of Florida. For established invasive species, the statutes outline a goal of maintenance control. That means keeping plants at their lowest feasible level over attempting eradication or treatment where there are complaints, specific to complaints. The funding priorities for aquatic plants are included in rule, with floating plants being the top priority, followed by new infestations of hydrilla, and then treatments of hydrilla to manage access and recreational opportunities. The statutes direct the Upland Invasive Plant Control Program to provide coordination and funding for upland plant control on public conservation lands, and we coordinate with the Florida Park Service, the Florida Forest Service, water management districts, county and city governments, as well as federal partners on more than 11 million acres that are covered in this program. Funding priorities for FWC and our partners include melaleuca, Kogan grass, Brazilian pepper, and climbing fern. For heavily infested areas, such as the example you see here in the before treatment picture of something like climbing fern, an initial substantial investment is needed to get that under control. And then annual treatment is often needed, or biannual treatment, to maintain it in the after-treatment condition at a much, much lower cost. For the remainder of this presentation, I am going to focus on the aquatic plant portion of our program. Florida's lakes and rivers are important resources to the state. They provide recreational opportunities for boating and swimming, fishing, hunting, wildlife viewing. Many of our constituents enjoy having lakeside homes, and our lakes and rivers provide drinking water. Many of them are also important for flood control throughout the state. With thousands of lakes and river miles in Florida and millions of people, there are many challenges to lake management. The historical hydrological cycles in Florida responded to our wet and dry seasons with large changes in water depth. This natural process was very good for our lakes. It deposited rich organic material in adjacent uplands during flood times and exposed lake bottoms during droughts, which allowed for oxidation of organic sediments and reducing the density of invasive plants. Water regulation for flood control has significantly changed this, with many lakes only seeing a few feet of change annually. At the same time, the areas around lakes have had changing uses, which has added nutrients to our systems and increased the growth of plants and the development of organic sediments. FWC's role in lake management is not specific just to invasive plants. We manage for healthy fish and wildlife populations, diverse habitats, and recreational opportunities. So in addition to managing invasive plants, we have programs that are restoring lakes with native plantings and shoreline stabilization projects, and we're managing and monitoring fish and wildlife populations and often augmenting fish populations. When we're considering invasive plant management actions, we're taking into account these additional roles of our agency. Invasive plants are those that are non-native to Florida and have the potential to have a negative impact on our habitats, human health and safety, and our economy. Invasive plants have very few natural predators, they grow very quickly, and they do require some type of management. As part of the Aquatic Plant Management Program, FWC monitors freshwater habitats to ensure that our management is addressing the issues and maintaining a diverse native plant population. The example that is shown here is Lake Jackson in Tallahassee from several years ago, and it demonstrates how we conduct transects to monitor for plant species, particularly our submerged plants, and then we create a heat map that shows the vegetation that's present as well as its density. On some of our bigger systems, like Lake Okeechobee, we fly flights along with our partners to detect coverage of floating plants from the air. These maps are critical to our planning process for aquatic plant management. I mentioned maintenance control earlier, and I would like to spend a little bit more time on what that means and why it's important. Maintenance control means that once an infestation has been removed, we try to keep it at the lowest possible levels. Research by the University of Florida on maintenance control, periodic control, and no control of water hyacinths had some very interesting results. They found that maintenance control uses less chemicals than periodic control. Maintenance control adds less organic material and nutrients to the water compared to periodic control, and it adds less organic material and nutrients than not controlling those plants at all. When we keep invasive plants at very low levels and we spot treat as needed, we have less of an environmental impact and we use less herbicides. To do this requires consistent monitoring and presence on all of our lakes. There are a variety of management tools that we can use to control invasive plants. We start by thinking about the overall management goal for a lake, not just for the plants, but also for the fish, wildlife, and the recreational users. And then we consider all of the options that are available to us for control. This is part of an integrated pest management program, which is the standard for how invasive species are managed. It maximizes effectiveness by using multiple approaches. We also consider specific lake conditions and available funding when we're deciding which approach to use. Chemical control is the use of herbicides. Physical control includes things like prescribed fire as well as drawdowns, and sometimes with very small infestations, we might use hand pulling of plants. Drawdowns are when we manipulate the water level so that we mimic a drought condition, and then sometimes we will follow that with mechanical removal of the organic sediments. Biological control uses the biological enemies of a host plant to target that plant, and mechanical control encompasses many different types of equipment that let us shred or harvest plant material that's in a lake. Each tool has its advantages and disadvantages, which is part of the process for deciding which one to use, along with those specific lake conditions and our management goals. For example, the use of herbicides can be selective, it can be lower cost, But if you use the same herbicide in the same area year after year, you're at risk of herbicide resistance, which means that the herbicide would be less effective. Physical control, as I said, mimics our natural processes. And when you're mimicking that drought process, you can actually see benefits that last for decades with the drawdown. However, it does require a lot of coordination, and it makes the water body potentially unusable to some user groups during that drought condition. Biological control is very specific, but it can also be expensive and take a long time to develop a biological control and test it to make sure it's safe for release in the state. And then finally, mechanical control. This is a process where we tend to remove the entire plant, but then we need to have a place for the deposition of that plant. And it can also be quite expensive and hard to do in shallow areas with heavy equipment. So there is no perfect tool for plant management, and cost is a factor that we have to consider. Historically, chemical treatment has cost us less than mechanical control. Costs do vary depending on the type of plant that we target. And in addition to that, you have to think about whether or not you're going to be able to do a single treatment, because a single treatment cost could be lower, but because you have to go back multiple times during a year, such as the case often with mechanical treatment, over time it actually ends up costing more. Herbicide use also varies annually depending on the condition of water bodies and if we're at maintenance control. Currently, we're at maintenance control statewide on floating plants, which has allowed us to decrease our use of herbicides for these species, which you can see here in green on the graph. As you can also see from the graph, where hydrilla is present, we have more variability in the treatment. And this is because we have some constituent groups that value hydrilla as habitat for hunting waterfowl and for fishing. Hydrilla, when it is found at low levels in lakes that do not have natural vegetation, can benefit some fish and wildlife. If we dive a little deeper into that hydrilla picture, it highlights the role of maintenance control for managing aquatic plants. There are 24 water bodies in Florida that are not in maintenance control, which sometimes we call proactive control. And to get those back into maintenance control would cost us roughly $16 million. We have 262 water bodies that are at maintenance control, and annually we spend roughly $2 million, $2.5 million on those lakes to keep them there. There are management-specific reasons to not follow a maintenance control philosophy, as I mentioned earlier, because on some of our lakes, it is providing important fishing and wildlife, fishing and hunting habitat. However, we do need to manage the costs and need to be carefully considering how we're managing hydrilla. FWC's invasive plant management program has had many management successes across multiple different species and using different control methods. In the uplands program, we are at greater than 85% maintenance control across the state on all public conservation lands, which is a huge success. There are 465 water bodies that are eligible for our program in Florida, and hydrilla is at 92% control. 92% of those water bodies are under maintenance control for hydrilla. And as I mentioned earlier, we are functionally at 100% control on floating plants, and that includes Lake Okeechobee. We use biological controls on several of our more problematic species. We use grass carp in about a quarter of the lakes in the state that are within the program for controlling hydrilla. And then we also have a pest that we have released back in the 1990s for alligator weed, which prior to the release of that species, alligator weed was one of our most expensive problems to control. And now 99% of the control is with the biological agent, and we do very little herbicide or other types of treatment for alligator weed. Our program continues to address high-priority invasive plants statewide, while we coordinate with other programs and agencies to achieve our management goals that benefit fish, wildlife, and their habitats. And with that, I conclude my presentation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, and members. This is a big deal. I never thought about it. It is the largest program in the country, larger than Alaska, California, Texas.
Yes, it is. And part of that is because we have a growing season that lasts year-round, and we're very susceptible to invasive species.
So are there any questions? Yes, Representative Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this presentation. Is FWC and partners looking at if there's any ecological benefits of hydrilla in some of these other invasive plants? And if so, does that change your management strategy,
Mr. Chair? So hydrilla is the one that we specifically look at because, again, we do have waterfowl hunters in particular that find hydrilla to be beneficial. It's one of those areas where the ducks will sit down and you can find them easily using that hydrilla. At high density levels, though, you see a decline in that. So there's benefit up to a point, and then when it becomes very dense and it takes over a very large area, it shades out every other plant type, and you actually have a thermocline that develops. So it'll be warmer water that's above and cold water that's below, and that isn't conducive to a wide variety of other fish and wildlife. So it may be beneficial to waterfowl, but it's not necessarily beneficial to a wide diversity, the full diversity that would be found in a lake.
Representative Overton.
Thank you so much. Just a couple questions on mechanical versus chemical. I know you've got a raw cost, I think it was slide 13 or so, that you had the comparison of the two. But that comparison also doesn't look at the overall removal of phosphorus, nitrogen, et cetera. Has FWC ever looked at that possibility in the long-term cost of mechanical versus chemical?
So we actually helped fund a pilot project several years ago that was looking at whether or not you were removing phosphorus if you were removing plant material that was typically floating plant material. They slurried it, provided it into an upland system, and then the idea was that you would harvest the plants and remove that material out of the watershed. That project was successful in demonstrating that you could do that process. They were still doing the analysis on the numbers of how much phosphorus actually came out of the system and then the uptake of that phosphorus into the plants that were going to leave the watershed. So I can't say that we have any hard numbers on that, but we did help fund a pilot project that was trying to get at that for us.
If we were, if you were looking at the overall mechanical versus chemical in your overall management strategy, what would you say percentage of chemical versus mechanical?
Probably 75% chemical, 25% mechanical, and a lot of that has to do with the specific conditions of the lakes. In order to use the mechanical equipment, most of it's very heavy and it's hard to do in shallow water, and shallow water is where you have that first, growth of invasive plants. And so if we wait for the plants to grow and move out into the lake, we can harvest them, but then we're not in maintenance control and we risk something getting away from us.
Just final question. When you're looking at alternative species managements and introducing other species, a while back we introduced a species to help with Melaleuca. And wondering if you have seen what the success is associated with that as well as Brazilian pepper.
I'd have to go back and look at those numbers. I remember we did the Melaleuca and the thrip for the Brazilian pepper, and I can go back and see if we've seen much success with them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I wondered what kind of program, if there is one, or what operation do you have for communicating with actual municipalities? The reason I ask is we had a canal in my district which had overgrown to the point it looked like one set of grassy area to another, and we had a group come in and help remove that from Lake Worth Water Management. But is there any kind of an organization where you could track who to go to or how to manage if there's an in-city canal affected? Thank you.
So I mentioned eligible waters, and I can clarify what that means for us and for our program. It needs to be publicly accessible and submerged sovereign lands. And so if we have water bodies that are housed within a neighborhood, or maybe it's a dredged canal that was part of an HOA, then it's not one of the water bodies that's within our eligible program. We do coordinate with counties very regularly on providing funding, and they are actually acting as cooperators in treating ineligible waterways. Then we have other counties and municipalities who will often provide that service for their constituents, because again, it's specific to the constituents that are in that county, and it's not accessible for public use, which is one of the criteria for us.
Thank you.
Representative Trunell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to waterfowl for a second. So when you take in consideration of waterfowl and how much vegetation you have on a lake, what determines how much you would leave for that, for the birds.
Mr. Chair. So we have several management plans for some of our larger systems, Kissimmee Chain of Lakes, Harris Chain of Lakes, Lake Okeechobee, Istipoga. And typically what we look at for submerged aquatic vegetation is a 30 to 40% coverage rate. We prefer that to be almost exclusively native vegetation, but as I mentioned, some of our lake systems, because of that accumulation of organic sediment, don't grow natives as well as hydrilla grows. Hydrilla is an invasive, it grows quickly and it grows easily. So 30 to 40% is what a lot of people would tell you is the goal. We would struggle to maintain a system at 30 to 40% if it were strictly hydrilla.
Follow up. So when we look at bird patterns and migration patterns, I mean, ducks for being the main species you're looking at, how much of the migration actually comes to Florida? And is that a consideration for how much you would leave for them?
I would actually want to defer to some of our waterfowl biologists to help answer that question. We are part of the Atlantic Coast Migratory Pathway, and there's annual variability in the number of birds that are here. But because you don't know in advance how many birds may be coming in any individual year, I think for a lot of people who are engaging in waterfowl hunting, they would like to see a maximum amount of vegetation in the hopes that they get a good season with a lot of birds coming to Florida. But we can follow up with our waterfowl biologist and get a better answer.
Very good question, and that is an issue that's beginning to emerge. And it's a tough one. Representative Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my question sort of picks up where Representative Oberdorf left off and alludes to your answer. You had mentioned that you did mechanical control, and in an experiment, a pilot project, you turned it into a slurry, removed it to the uplands. You found that that was an effective way of removing organic matter. My question would be, have you explored maybe not removing it so far, but instead removing it on studied the feasibility of removing it on an industrial scale and composting it, turning it then to an agricultural product that might be sold? Because if that's feasible, then you have an ongoing way to remove nutrient loads from lots of our waterways and in a way that would be very cost-effective, even profitable, and really good for our farmers.
So I mentioned that one of the difficulties of mechanical harvesting is finding a place to house the material while it decays. And so we have to find those upland disposal sites, or we have to permit with the Army Corps of Engineers inland, in-water disposal sites. So sometimes you might be in a lake system and you'll see a large area where we've disposed of material for a long period of time. So those are two options that we currently use. Being able to turn it into an agricultural product, I think that that's a really interesting idea. And if somebody had a proposal for how to do that, I think we would be very interested in entertaining what that would look like.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for your answer. So let me understand. So you have not studied the feasibility of composting it, and it seems then that the only thing holding that up is the identification of a suitable location?
I think that probably someone would need to turn in a proposal to us that we would evaluate for that. Suitable location might be one problem. I'm not sure from the agricultural standpoint. Some of the times when I've heard this discussed, there's concerns that the removal of the material may have components in it that you would not necessarily want to apply to another field. And I feel like I'm a little out of my depth on that, so I can certainly look into it and find you a different answer.
Representative Kilbrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're doing mechanical and biological or chemical and other things, do you all have to get permits from, say, Water Management District or DEP?
So if we are doing the mechanical treatment or the herbicide treatment, then no, we do not necessarily need to get a permit in order to do that. Although one of the statutes that I mentioned early on does require that a permit be received from our agency if other people are doing those activities. So we're the permitting entity for those activities. I did mention that sometimes we're doing scraping or removing of organic sediments. Once you start to disturb the ground under the water, then we have to go to the Army Corps and the Water Management District for permits.
So you permit yourself?
We do not require permits for our activities.
Okay. And one other question. How do you get rid of kudzu?
I am not sure.
I know they got a lot of that up in Georgia. I think they're being pretty successful. Yeah. Okay, I have a couple questions. I know just recently it's brought to my attention, it's not recently, it's been going for decades, but it's been brought back up. The application of herbicide in water bodies that are used for drinking water. Are we applying herbicides in lakes that are being used for public consumption?
So in some instances, yes. There's labeling on every herbicide that you use, and the label, we would say very often, the label is the law. And so it has very specific parameters under which you can apply it if there is a drinking water source that's in that lake. And we also post at those lakes when we're going to be doing that treatment. So if there are any concerns or any requirements for posting that are on that label, then we always do those things. And there are certain herbicides or types of treatments that are better than others.
Now, that labeling and those protective measures, are we doing research, or we're relying more on the federal EPA or chemical companies? How can we give the public assurance that this is safe?
So there's two levels of review for this. The US EPA approves an herbicide for use, and then the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services has a very stringent process for approving them specific to the state of Florida. State of Florida is different. Our water bodies are different. Our warm weather year-round is different. Degradation rates of herbicides are different. So they actually look very specifically to ensure that they are safe for public use.
Is there, I'm sure there's testing to determine if there's any residual chemicals in the water after it's been treated?
Correct. And we actually did a project several years ago on Lake Istipoga because people were concerned about what they called legacy or residual herbicides in the soil or in the sediments. And the study that UF did took multiple soil samples all across the lake, repeated it over the course of several months, and never actually found any residual herbicides in any part of Lake Istipoga. So that's one lake, but it has been looked at and tested, and we did it very specifically on a lake of concern.
Yeah. Roseanne Black, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, can we get together after this meeting so that we can arrange to discuss further the mechanical removal and composting study, maybe discuss that offline?
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Thank you.
I think it's excellent. It's a very good idea. And I think it shows that we as a committee and need to work with our agencies to provide ample funding and to continue to look at technology and innovation and how we can do this better, more complete, and turn some of this into a benefit, like the creating of good, clean compost, because a lot of these freshwater aquatic vegetation types are relatively, they're clean, and a good, clean source of compost. Okay, I think that pretty much answers all our questions here, and thank you so much for, we really appreciate, this is a very important issue, and we value this on this committee, and we thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Mary Ellen Winkler, Assistant Executive Director for the St. Johns River Water Management District. Ms. Winkler, you're recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for inviting me to speak today. I'm Mary Ellen Winkler, the Assistant Executive Director for the St. Johns River Water Management District, and I'm very pleased to be able to speak with you today about our restoration efforts at Lake Apopka. Lake Apopka is the fourth largest lake in Florida. It's over 30,000 acres in size. It is the headwaters for the upper Ocklawaha River Basin. The Ocklawaha eventually drains into the St. Johns River in North Florida. Portions of Lake Apopka are in Orange and Lake counties. Lake Apopka was Florida's original tourist attraction. It was home to many fish camps. Anglers throughout the country visited Lake Apopka for its fishing opportunities and wildlife. Lake Apopka was actually historically 50,000 acres in size. The wetland restoration area on the graphic above on the slide, that area was actually part of the lake and was a marsh system. In the late 1800s, it was desired to have a waterway connection between the lakes in this area, and the Apopka-Beauclair Canal was dug. With that action back then, the lake level dropped about 4 feet at that time. And what that did was it then exposed the soils on the northern part of the marsh such that farming activities could take place. And over the next several decades from the late 1800s up until the 40s, there were basically boom and bust cycles of farming on the North Shore. But with World War II, the need for farming and agriculture and feeding our troops was paramount. And so with improved technology and a better levee system, farming activities really took off on the North Shore. And in fact, it was fairly intensive. They had about 3 crop cycles each year. Unfortunately, those activities led to degradation in Lake Apopka, and those activities on the North Shore were about 85% of the phosphorus load to Lake Apopka. So we started to see algal blooms and loss of submerged aquatic vegetation, habitat, and various declines. In response, the legislature was very active with Lake Apopka in the late 80s, this was one of our first surface water improvement lakes where we developed a plan. But in 1996, major action was taken to restore Lake Apopka. We were directed by the legislature to purchase the farming operations on the North Shore. That was a $115 million investment, the vast majority, $80 million of which were provided by the legislature. As part of that legislation, another important element of it was that the target phosphorus concentration was set. And that 55 parts per billion concentration was what scientists estimated at the time was when submerged aquatic vegetation would return, the conditions would be appropriate. With everything that the state and the district has done, we have about $200 million invested in the last 30 years in the restoration of this lake. And this has been achieved, and I'm going to use a diet and exercise analogy. Basically, the diet, we've reduced phosphorus entering the lake, and then the exercise is removal of that legacy phosphorus from the lake. And I'm going to highlight some of those actions that we've taken over the last 30 years. Acquisition of the North Shore farms was critical because it was 85% of the load. We also have a special basin criteria for the Apopka Basin. This is where, in addition to the environmental resource permitting requirements, the base requirements, there's an additional requirement in Apopka that there's no net discharge of phosphorus, no increased load. And so you may have to, if you're developing a residential subdivision or a commercial property in that area, your stormwater pond might be a little bit bigger. So we increase the residents' time to get more phosphorus removal. We've also invested significant cost-share dollars for water quality improvement projects. On the exercise front, I'll touch on our harvest of rough fish and our marsh flyway in detail, but we also have a phosphorus removal project that Nequatic has been working on for us. In terms of cost share investment, our district has invested $7.3 million in Orange and Lake counties. That's resulted, when you consider local match, $32.4 million of projects. In the Ocklawaha Basin, we have an investment of $29 million for the district. And again, when matched with local dollars, we have constructed $80 million worth of projects. Our marsh flowway has been very successful. You can see the amount, the total pounds of phosphorus removed. This is basically a wetland treatment system where we pump water into the wetland system. It's about 760 acres in size. And what we do is we filter that water through in the wetlands, and the vegetation remove algae. It removes suspended solids, and it also helps us reduce the nutrient load. And you can see the water in and then the water out, the clarity is much improved. We can pump about 40% of the volume of the lake through that system each year. So this has been a very effective tool for us in removing phosphorus from the lake. Another important exercise regimen that we use with Lake Apopka is our rough fish harvest. Gizzard shad is a rough fish, and basically this type of fish thrives in water that is turbid and basically in poor quality. The fish themselves, that's removing phosphorus, but also importantly, rough fish are filter feeders, which means they disturb the sediments at the bottom of Lake Apopka. And when they do that, that releases more phosphorus into the environment. In addition, they feed on zooplankton, which is feeds on blue-green algae. So it's kind of the rough fish are kind of a double whammy to the system. They're removing something that's beneficial to get rid of blue-green algae, but they're also problematic because they're disturbing sediments. We've been doing this for a long time. We've been very successful for us. In other lakes and in this chain of lakes, we've discontinued our rough fish harvesting program because the game fish are back. And it's also a sign that the water quality is back to where we need it to be. So a very good sign that other lakes in the chain have recovered sufficiently so that we can discontinue, and hopefully soon we'll achieve the same here in Lake Apopka. So in summary, we have just last year hit the 55 parts per billion target. This was a very exciting moment for us, for our engineers, scientists, and staff who've worked for 30 years to achieve that goal. We've also, on the chart on the left, you'll see that's from our status and trends report. And what those triangles in the downward direction indicate is that there's a decreasing amount of phosphorus. So we are going in the right direction. So we are very proud of the work that we're doing here and the partnerships that we've had to get to this day. The work is not over. That phosphorus concentration will go up and down based on conditions like rainfall and other things, but the trend is good. The trend is where we need it to be going. Now that the system is much healthier, we're seeing the public start to recreate out at Lake Apopka again. It's become a very popular birding site. We have 369 bird species that utilize the area. We've actually created a wildlife drive on our property, and it is our most popular recreation site of all of our district properties, and that's helping with the local economy. So we're very proud of the work that's been done, and The people in the local community have been very supportive and are using our public land. Another thing that has come back is submerged aquatic vegetation. In 1994, we had 0 acres. In 2020, another survey was done, and we had 96% of the shoreline had submerged aquatic vegetation, so tremendous progress. Next steps. As I mentioned, our work is not done. We are trending in the right direction, but additional work is needed. And I'll touch on these in a little bit more detail in the next couple of slides, but we're continuing to plant submerged aquatic vegetation, managing exotic species like hydrilla. Next year, we will be updating our land management plan for the North Shore. We are also looking at some feasibility studies for what is the next generation of project for Lake Apopka. In terms of SAV, there is some seed source there, and there are it is recovering on its own, but we're also trying to jumpstart that recovery with planting. We are working with the University of Florida on planting techniques to make that effort successful, also looking at various species and varieties. We've invested about $1.5 million in that project and looking to do more funding. We also have received funds from FWC and very much appreciate their cooperation and financial support. So they've been very, very helpful to us on this project. And again, these are two of the native species that we are reintroducing. As was mentioned by Ms. Tucker, we have seen hydrilla, and this is one of those intensity maps that was mentioned. We have seen, unfortunately, as predicted, submerged aquatic vegetation is coming back. We're seeing native, but unfortunately, we're also seeing the exotic species hydrilla come back as well. And it has expanded rapidly in the last 3 years. And for us, this poses several concerns. This is what it looks like. This was the last week of October. That's one of our boats that we use to take drone footage of the hydrilla. This is from that very dense red area that you saw on the screen. You can also see some lines through the hydrilla. That's where boats have gone through. And unfortunately, the hydrilla easily fragments and gets caught in propellers. And again, that then spreads it to other areas of the lake. So the boat that you see in the picture actually got stuck several times trying to get this imagery with hydrilla and the propeller. So poses a significant problem. I did want to spend a moment, and this is one of the things that at the St. John's we're trying to do a better job of communicating. For our flood protection, Lake Apopka, there is a canal that is the only discharge for Lake Apopka. It's the only relief valve that we have. We are concerned and do not want hydrilla, which can, as I said, fragment, ball up, and during storm events, clog things up. So we want to make sure that we maintain the outlet for Lake Apopka free of vegetation so we can do what we are part of our job, which is flood protection. Hydrilla can outgrow. I think we, Ms. Tucker mentioned that exotics sometimes they have growth rates that are much more than our native species. Hydrilla grows at an exponential rate. So for example, if you had 200 acres 1 year, you may have 700 the next. So it's that exponential growth curve is very challenging. And as I mentioned, it easily fragments and can infest other areas. And it impacts our ability to do our shad harvest work and recreational boating. And again, as was mentioned, it is cheaper to keep things at maintenance control, and it's less herbicide. So we are concerned about it, and we want to make sure that the investment of the state and the legislature is protected. I did want to touch on structural flood control. In the St. Johns River Water Management District, we have two areas where we have structural flood protection, which is what you would classically think of as dams and levees. One is that those areas are delineated in this graphic in orange, and one is the upper basin of the St. Johns River, and the other is Apopka and that chain of lakes. In other areas of the St. Johns River, we typically use wetlands and floodplain as our non-structural flood controls so that when you have significant rain events, the water can be stored in floodplain. In the upper Ocklawaha River Basin, we actually control and regulate the water levels in Lakes Apopka, Dora, Beauclair, Eustis, Harris, and Griffin. And if you look on the graphic, there's the Apopka below Beauclair Lock and Dam, and you'll see that pencil thin line. That is the canal system and the outlet and the relief mechanism that we use to relieve Lake Apopka flooding, and it basically goes down the chain and down to the river system. So very important. These are regulated structures. We work with the Army Corps of Engineers on these structures, so very important to us. To address these concerns, we greatly appreciate the legislature providing us with funds last year for hydrilla treatment and for urgent needs. Just last week, we did a treatment in the White Polygon areas, treating herbicide, trying to keep the hydrilla boxed in and away from the AB canal. We used multiple herbicides. The combinations that were used were designed, it's like a prescription. It was designed so that we wouldn't hurt any of those returning native species. So it was very carefully constructed. We will evaluate, it will take some weeks before we know the success of that. And so then we will evaluate how we did and see where we need to go from here. But this is a big first step, and we appreciate the support and also the knowledge that was provided by FWC and their expertise and on those herbicide combinations so that we did things appropriately. Last, we are just working.
I wanted to highlight. So last year, we gave $2 million, I think, to FWC to support the submerged aquatic vegetation, $2.5 million. FWC worked with St. John's, and then we also appropriated $5 million. You know, that was not earmarked specifically for hydrilla or aquatic.
No, sir.
That was to be spent however
Lake Apopka, yes,
the
sir.
District felt that it would be best spent. I want to make that clear. We didn't dictate.
No, sir.
That was a decision we left up to the district. And that was very significant because we have in statute an allocation for Lake Apopka. That's something that was debated many years ago, but that hasn't been funded like it was originally hoped. And I think it says a lot for this committee and the legislature that we have valued that resource and have restored some of that funding.
Yes, sir. It was extremely helpful, and we felt that this treatment was the most urgent need for those funds. So we took the $2 million that was specifically appropriated for hydrilla management and then some of the additional money for Lake Apopka in general. Our intent is to use any remaining funds for planting. So we saw those as the two most critical needs, our hydrilla, getting that red zone under control, and then also planting, providing that submerged aquatic vegetation. Lastly, our next step is every 10 years, we do we revise our land management plans, and the next year is the year that we would focus on the Lake Apopka North Shore. currently on, we are looking at in the area in Fuchsia, that's called the West Marsh. And we're doing evaluations now to see what additional activities we can undertake there. Should we do another flowway? We're also investigating making it a new waterfowl area, and we've started our conversations with FWC. Now's the time to have those discussions because we can design it in such a way to make it more favorable conditions for waterfowl. So that's going to be part of the discussion as we move forward this year, and we're very excited about that and looking at some feasibility studies as we move forward. So that's a little peek into 2024 as we move forward. And with that, thank you again for allowing me time to share the success story of Lake Apopka and our continued work.
Great, thank you, very informative. Yes, Representative Hart and Representative Cross.
Thank you.
Representative Trunell, then after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question back on the North Shore public use. I see a picture where there's actual fish. Are people able to fish there now? I see that you had the bird.
Yes, ma'am. They are having, actually, I think it's ongoing as we speak. There's bass tournaments now that utilize the lake and then the chain of lakes. And I know FWC may have more information on that, but it's become, and I think they may have done some stocking too, but yes, it's become a very popular bass fishing area, and I believe they have multiple tournaments there each year. So we're seeing the game fish come back. So that's also a good, very good sign.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the marsh flowway. What was the previous land use before its current configuration, and what type of plants are you using for that phosphorus removal?
Yes, it was part, the marsh flowway was part of the old farmland. And I don't know, I'm not the plant expert, but we did select, there is a selection of plants. We actually just went through, because it was 20 years old, we had recently some of the water, you develop preferential flow paths. So we just did a project where we recontoured and just did some plantings and some other things. So I can get back with you on the specific plants. I apologize, I don't know them off the top of my head.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So speaking of the flowway a little bit more, can you explain exactly how it works so members can understand how the water enters and leaves, and maybe speak to, you know, what is its life expectancy? I mean, how much phosphate can it hold, and when would we have to make a major change to, you know, reconstitute that flowway for the next generation?
So the way that works is we pump water into treatment cells, and there's total, there's the four that you see there. We basically, the water works through and it sheet flows across. And as it does, and it takes between 2 to 7 days for the water to basically run from the input to the outfall. And so the water works its way through this wetland system. And as it does so, suspended solids drop out, the algae drops out. We also get uptake from the plants that are there. You're correct. We do have to maintain it. You can't, this is, the marsh flowway is not something that you can just leave it. We've had over the years had to do these projects where we have to go in, recontour, replant. And so I can get you the specific numbers from our last treatment, but it'll be a couple million dollars at a time where we go through and do that contouring work, replanting, and then it's also pumps, getting the water, pumping the water into the system, and then pumping it back into the lake. So there's pump maintenance also involved. And these are really significant, large pumps. in the $1 million range. So that's it. It is an effort, but we have an annual work plan and a five-year work plan, and so that is built into our operation and maintenance costs at the district.
Follow up: do we use alum in that treatments?
Not in this one.
So, from what I understand, you pump the water in, but it free flows back to the lake.
We do have the, and I should say, we do have alum as needed. If we don't use it all the time, there is alum in that area that we can use. There are pumps to, you know, because over time, this area from the mechanical operations that have occurred over time and how the land was managed, the land level on the North Shore has basically subsided 5 feet. So it takes a bit to move things around. So that's why we need pumps and other things. So because of subsidence and other things, there's a little bit of mechanical effort to get things moved around.
When we talk about Lake Apopka, you know, most people know I'm very familiar with Lake Apopka, have farmed there for most of my life. So, you know, a lot of things have happened in the last 30 years, and we've made a lot of great momentum forward, and I appreciate all the work that you guys have been doing and hope to continue just like what we've been talking about today. But, you know, we've had a lot of other things on the agenda to try to get done, but, you know, the lake has turned and gotten better, and the hydrilla has taken off. And the reason why the hydrilla has taken off is because the lake is getting better. But at the same time, you know, to control the hydrilla, we have to clean the water some more. So being the headwater of the Ocklawaha Basin, it's very important that we take the time to take care of Lake Apopka, because it's going to help take care of Lake Beauclair, Lake Dora, Lake Harris, Lake Eustis, all the way up the chain. So we've been sprinkling a little bit of money in Lake Apopka to manage the needs, but we really need to take a better focus on Lake Apopka to achieve the goals in a little bit faster time, which, again, like I said, it's going to improve all the waterways downline. So thank you for what you've done. I'm here to help you, and we're here to help you and achieve those goals as well.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there still farms operating on the North Shore in the area that you had delineated on the map earlier?
We don't have anything on the 20,000 acres. I think at the time we got what we needed, and that's the main contributor. So we don't really have anything left on the North Shore. That the 20,000 acres is now in public ownership. So we're it's really been converted to public land.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yep. A follow up, and thank you for that answer. So to the north of the public land, are there farms operating there?
There are, yes, there are farms that as you go further north, there are farms. Some of it is transitioning. This is an area that is developing very quickly. So we do see some transition from agriculture to residential.
Now I have a separate question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, ma'am, for that answer. As to your gizzard shad harvest and other rough fish, how do you dispose of them, and have you explored the possibility of selling them to pet food companies?
Actually, thank you for asking that question. It is actually a public-private partnership. We get the gizzard shad removed at a reduced rate because the person, the company that does it actually sells the fish, and it becomes basically food for crayfish in Louisiana. So it's actually sold and used. I think they've tried different experiments, but the thing that seemed to work out the best was using it as crayfish food.
So think about it when you eat crawdads. Any other questions? I have some questions, just a couple, a comment. As far as nutrient removal out of the lake, are there any other techniques that are being done by the district or other entities?
So right now, the primary focus we have are the marsh flowway. We do have the Nuquatic, which is basically removing some sediment flock from the kind of that upper layer of the lake and then just off the North Shore. So those would be some of the primary things that we're doing. And we're just also just looking for any opportunities that we can find for any remnant water quality. For example, we have a project with the city of Lake Apopka where there are areas still that are on septic tanks. And they're changing them to they have now very advanced septic systems. So we're always looking for opportunities in addition to the shad harvest, the flowway, and the Nuquatic. And that's part of the feasibility study that we're going to be working on this coming year. We're at that point where we're starting to look at what is the next generation, what more can we do to jumpstart recovery.
Excellent, excellent. What is the Nuquatic?
It's a facility basically that is on the North Shore. It was part of an innovative project, but basically it takes sediments they have an operation where they take the sediments and it's the very top layer, like the flock, and they also some from the water column, and they have a proprietary process to remove it, and then I think they also have found a way to dispose of the product in a commercial way that it can make the business part of it work for them. So we're, again, always looking for opportunities and options to explore.
Fantastic. If you've had an opportunity to be in Lake County and the chain of lakes, it's a uniquely beautiful area, and it like the Everglades, it's unique, and it's sort of a mini Everglades project. And Lake Apopka is the second largest lake in Florida, right?
Fourth largest. Yes,
okay, I got that wrong. Who are the other two? I don't know.
I'll find out.
Let me know. But it's one of the largest lakes in Florida, and this lake system is unique. It's good to have a resident representative on our committee with Representative Trunau. And it's an incredible regional resource for many people across the state. So we appreciate what FWC is doing and what St. John's is doing in trying to restore this to its grandeur and glory. One of the greatest bass fishing locations on the planet at one time. And looking forward to being a part of helping you restore that. And we thank you. Both presentations were excellent. So glad we had them and looking forward to working with you guys in the future.
Thank you, sir.
I think this concludes our meeting. And if there, I don't think we have any further business, no cards from the public, and seeing none, Representative Black moves that we rise. Without objection, the meeting is